Previously, I worked in a totally different sector, and I really wanted to spend my life looking at things I really get passionate about. So I could not think of anything else than languages and words that I have been always passionate about. So I thought, if you live only once, you definitely need to do what you really love. And that was a language. And the way to think about language all the time in my life was to become a researcher in linguistics. So yeah, I think it is fair to say that it is part of my ikigai. And also, in general, I'm interested in language, and more generally, I'm interested in communication. So when I'm having a very good, interesting discussion with other people, that gives me a really a great pleasure that this exchange of ideas is something that I appreciate a lot. So that's a moment I feel that this is kind of part of the beautiful, most beautiful part of life in general. So yeah, I'd say that in general, this language, words, and communication that gives me a sense of ikigai.
This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast, Japanese wisdom for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Find your ikigai at ikigaitribe.com. Hello, it's Nick Kemp here with episode 43 of the Ikigai Podcast. My guest today is Naoko Hosekawa, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tokyo. Naoko obtained her PhD in Oriental Studies at the University of Oxford in 2015. She holds a Master's of Sciences in International Relations from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and a Master of Arts in Political Science from Columbia University, and a Bachelor of Arts in Policy Management from Keio University, so very qualified. And Naoko's main fields of research are social linguistics and media discourse analysis related to the question of national and regional identity. She was previously an invited researcher at the French Network for Asian Studies, CNRS, which I believe is the French National Center for Scientific Research in France, and also the France-Japan Foundation, EHESS Paris, and the European University Institute. Her recent publications include articles on ethnicity and nationalism and myths in crisis, the crisis of myth. So after that very long introduction, Naoko, thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Yes, thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you very much for inviting me to this talk.
That's my pleasure. So as you know and discovered from me contacting you, I'm very interested in Japanese words and Japanese culture, and I recently discovered the concept of kotodama. And I did a search on Google and found your article, Kotodama, the Multi-Faced Japanese Myth of the Spirit of Language. So this is probably a good spot for us to start. What is kotodama? How would you describe it?
So in general, I think we can say that it is a popular myth of a spirit of language. And people often use expressions such as, if you keep saying what you would like to achieve in your life, you'll be able to achieve in reality thanks to kotodama. So that's a very general ideal kotodama today. However, the origin of the term is actually unknown. So with some earliest record of the term used in history, we can say that kotodama was linked to the idea of Yamato, which is an old name for Japan. So the notion of kotodama is often linked with the linguistic identity of Japan. And what is interesting is that the narrative surrounding kotodama have been reinvented according to non-linguistic factors surrounding Japan, and also the idea of purity of language in general.
I see. Yeah, it seems to combine, I guess it's almost like a form of positive self-talk, but there seems to be elements of karma associated to the word. And in your article, you mentioned three faces of kotodama, and the first was the ancient face. So would you like to touch on what that is?
Yes. So as I said, the exact origin and the exact background, how the term kotodama came into being is unknown, but it seems to be some sort of ancient ritual of Shintoism. And we can say this word mentioned a few times in the collection of poems from the 8th century called Manyoshu. And we can say that this word was used within some sort of animism. So the idea of Kotodama was very closely linked to the idea of God and also mm-hmm. idea of country. And as you say, yes, it's kind of similar to idea that exists in many different languages. And what is particularly interesting about this Japanese term Kotodama is that it has been reinvented surrounding the idea of purity of language. So the people believed, or it has been discussed as the spirit of language that only resides in the pure Japanese language. So I just mentioned the ancient phase, but also it is interesting to mention the early modern time of the concept during the Edo period. So just before the modernization, westernization of the country, there was a group of native scholars who formed a school called Kotodama, and they discussed the value of the phonetic element of the Japanese language. And they always compared the Japanese values to the Chinese influence on Japan, which was by then was very, very strong. So they described the Japanese language as the phonetic language, and they described the Chinese language as a written language. Then they also mentioned the Indian language, which probably is a Sanskrit language because they were familiar with the Buddhist scripture written in Sanskrit. And they said it's the language which is spoken, but sometimes recorded in a written form. So there was this idea of the purity or uniqueness of the Japanese language, which is always associated with the idea of Kotodama.
Okay, so it's a little bit complex. But if we wanted to simplify just what the word means, could we understand it as something like word spirit or the spirit of words or maybe even word karma?
Yes, so the Kotodama itself, when we look at the word, Koto means a language or words, and Dama is like soul or spirit. So the general idea of spirit of word was soul of language. And it is similar to, well, the basic idea is similar to many idea about the spirit of language that exists also in European context as well.
Okay, so would that mean there is some emphasis or belief that the words you use and how you say them might impact others? And I'm wondering if it also has any impact on why the Japanese language has a very polite structure to it.
Yes, I think it might be some connection to the importance placed on the use of the language in general in Japanese culture. So it's not only about the politeness, but also many other ways of expressions that people often associate their identity to the language. And so it's a core of the cultural identity of the Japanese society. And people place importance on this topic. And that's why often expression like Kotodama is mentioned when they talk about like Japanese identity or Japanese culture or Japanese tradition in general.
All right. Well, let's move on to your article again and touch on the second face, which was wartime face. So can you talk about that?
Sure. So I mentioned that there had been already a lot of reinterpretation of this term up to the modernization period. But with the modernization of the or westernization of Japan in the late 19th century, a large number of Western loanwords came in. However, when the war broke out, actually the idea of Kotodama was coupled with this idea of national polity or expressed in the Japanese language, kokutai, which is kind of body of the nation. And at that time, the use of Western loanwords was very strictly banned, because they're considered to be the language of the enemies. Mm-hmm. And on the contrary, the use of Chinese character, which was in a way denied in the earlier scholars of Kotodama, was actually reinvented as the core of the identity of the East Asia in a way which was a very useful thing when Japan was trying to create this Eastern Asian community. So the idea was completely changed. And there were lots of Western words replaced by this invented Japanese expressions using Chinese characters. So we can give some examples like lagubi, which is long ones from English, rugby, which mm-hmm. was replaced by tokyu, it means a fighting ball, or the English word announcer, which is long from the English announcer, was replaced by hoso in, which is a Chinese character's Sino-Japanese words, meaning broadcasting person. Mm-hmm. So this kind of language policy was very salient during the wartime.
Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com. Now back to the episode. Yeah, this reminds me of the first time I went to Japan and a friend said, hey, do you want to go see Yakyu? And I'm like, Yakyu? You know, what's that? And they said, oh, baseball. And I remember asking several Japanese, we don't play baseball in Australia, but we know the sport. But I remember asking, why is it called Yakyu? And no one could really tell me. So can you add some light to why Yakyu remains Yakyu and it's not referred to as baseball in Japan today?
Yeah, so actually the expression Yakyu was not invented during the war. It's aria long. So it was translated or coined during the modernization or westernization period. And how this term is coined exactly is again unknown, but it has been said that one of the baseball players used this expression in his writing and people liked it, so kept using the term and it got stabilized in the Japanese language. But in a way, it was quite common to make long translation instead of direct translation in the late 19th century and early 20th century when Japan was modernizing and taking lots of Western words into Japanese. So Yakyu is not only one example from this time, but there were many other examples of the words that were taken from Western languages, but not directly as a direct loan, but as loan translation. Mm-hmm. So it's an example of such words, and it means field ball if we translate the term just literally. And they are written in Chinese characters, so it looks like a sign of Japanese loans, even though it was probably coined in Japan.
Okay, so the word kyu means ball. And so for the case of tokyu, to refers to fighting and ya refers to field. So it's fascinating when you look at the etymology or the kanji characters of Japanese words and how they approach translating foreign words. But your article talks a lot about the idea of purity of language and loan words. Some people believe, some Japanese believe that loan words are threatening the country of Kotodama or this idea of Kotodama. So I think that presents an interesting debate. And it got me thinking, if Japanese don't use loan words, what are they to use? Do they just make up words to represent these loan words or concepts?
So yes, as you said, at the early time of the modernization, the Japanese tended to translate the Western words into a loan translation. And those who would like to use more of the pure form of Japanese or criticize the use of Western loan words tend to argue that we should use the technique of loan translation more than direct translation. Even though today it is quite rare as the number of loan words that we use in the Japanese language is increasing quite rapidly. So yeah, today we often hear this idea of Kotodama in the context of the use of loan words. So once the war phase has finished, we continue to talk about Kotodama, even though the context has slightly changed. And now people associate this term not so much with the political identity, but more with the cultural and linguistic identity. And when we talk about, for example, the use of loanwords and increasing number of English words, for example, used in the Japanese language, some people think it is against the concept of kotodama. So people argue that we should use the loan translation and we should kind of learn from the examples from the early late 19th century time that when we used a lot of loan translation. So that is some of the arguments that they use still today regarding the use of the Western words.
All right. So it's this clear, obviously there's a clear difference between loan translation and direct translation, and loan translation seeks to keep the purity or maintain the purity of the language, where I guess direct translation's acknowledging, yeah, we're accepting a foreign word.
Yes, so they are both way of foreign words. So in a way, they're the same thing, just the format is different. But it seems to me that in the Japanese discourse, people place a very strong focus on the difference between the two. And as you just said, people think the loan translation is a way to preserve the purity and traditional form of the Japanese language, whereas direct loans is some sort of corruption in the traditional tradition of the language, which is quite interesting.
Well, it is interesting. And I remember living in Japan, I would come across so many, I guess, loan words and being kind of confused as to why they were... Why was that word chose for this English word? And I have a really good example, and that was this memory of my brother-in-law offering me a Coke and saying, juice nomu? And I'm thinking, what? Juice? That's not juice. It's a Coke or it's a soft drink. And I found that a little bit, I don't know, I just found that frustrating. Like, why would you translate soft drink to juice? So sort of think, oh, they've got that wrong or that's unusual. Yeah, so why is it that some English loanwords take on slightly different nuanced meanings in Japanese?
It largely depends on the context in which the word was first borrowed and people started using it in one way and everyone followed the example. So I think that's the case for this word, the juice. But if you look at more broadly, actually, it is a quite common linguistic phenomenon to have slightly different meaning when you borrow a word into foreign language. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, for example, today in the German language, handy is used to mean mobile phone, whereas in English, it is not used that way, even though handy comes from the English expression. So this kind of slight change of meaning is natural phenomenon in the history of language. And if we look further in history, we can find many of these examples that meaning has been narrowed down and expanded or shifted. So, for example, the German word Tier is actually the origin of the word deer in English. And the German word Tier refers to animals in general, and today is still used for animals in general. Tiergarten is a zoo. However, in English, in our English, they use the word deer to mean small animals, but today it only means one kind of animal. So the meaning of the word was narrowed down in history. So this kind of thing happens over time. And I think a case for English words in the Japanese language can also follow similar paths. And it is in a way expected when you see foreign words in another language.
It's an interesting concept, isn't it? How do foreign countries that borrow words, yeah, define them, or how do they decide how we're going to use, what word should we use to describe this concept? Should we use the same word? Should we use a similar word? Or should we just use a completely different word that we think is appropriate? So I guess there's a lot of pressure on the person who first decides what to use, or maybe it's very serendipitous and it just sort of happens.
Yes, often we don't know how it started exactly, so we cannot trace the whole history, but it happens in a way naturally.
Hmm. So on this theme, there is a word you're focused on recently, and it is an interesting and perhaps unusual use of this word, which is refugee, which in Japanese is nanmin. And you wrote a paper on this titled From Reality to Discourse, Analysis of the Refugee Metaphor in the Japanese News Media. So this is very niche and it got me thinking, wow, it's really is amazing how, to what degree or to what niche people study subjects. So I found this fascinating. You've spent time studying essentially one word and how it's used as a metaphor in media. And the paper examines a recent trend in the Japanese news media of using the term refugee as a metaphor. And just to be clear, we're actually talking about the word nanmin, aren't we?
That's right. So it's the use of the metaphor of the term nanmin, which is a word for refugee in Japanese. And actually, it is a long translation from the expression refugee. So we're still talking about the translation.
So I think we can start with, I think, giving some background into Japan and I guess their refugee admission rate, which some people might know is quite low, less than 100 a year. And in our country, in Australia, we take in a lot, I guess, being a multi-culture. So, yeah, why does Japan grant asylum to so few refugees?
Yes, so Japan, even among the developed nations, Japan is by far the last country to accept refugees. And there have been a lot of explanations from different points of view, legal, political, societal. And some people point out that one of the reasons why Japan takes so few refugees is that the concept of refugee protection is actually kind of reinterpreted as refugee control. So the idea of controlling people coming from outside is still strong. Mm. And that is due to myth of the Japanese homogeneity. So even though it is not true, there is still some persistent idea that the Japanese society is so homogenous. So if you accept so many foreigners or people from other parts of the world, this harmony might be corrupted. So that is an erroneous idea, of course, but there are still some people who believe in this kind of things. So that might be one of the reasons why the refugee protection does not get a lot of civil society support. And I started to looking at the expression refugee or nanmin to see maybe I can find another way of kind of explaining why Japanese population is not so engaged in refugee protection, or there has been why there has been so few cases of civil society kind of standing up to kind of challenge the government to increase the acceptance of the refugees.
I mean, it's a timely subject for debate because Japan has an aging population, a declining birth rate, and they're forecasting significant problems with this. So they need to find solutions to these two problems. Perhaps refugee intake could be part of that solution. Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that, about this declining population and this idea of perhaps, you know, maintaining Japan's identity and unique culture? It seems like a real challenge.
Indeed, yes. So, of course, Japan needs people from outside of the country to maintain the level of population, but it's not only that the world has been internationalizing in general. And for Japan to follow the global standard, Japan needs to be diversified and Japanese society needs to be more diverse. That's the general idea. And I think given other conditions for Japan, like economic level, Japan is still not sufficiently diverse compared to other countries with their similar economic situation. So you are right in pointing out that this is a real challenge for the Japanese society, how to deal with this sort of erroneous myths in the Japanese homogeneity with this increasing diversity within the society. So in Japan as well, the number of foreign residents has been increasing every year. So this has already started and we cannot stop this and we should not stop this. And how to cope with this evolving condition for the Japanese society with this idea of kind of Japanese-ness or Japanese purity, which seems to be a very, very popular idea, is a very important issue for Japan to deal with.
Yeah, this is really interesting for me because I loved living in Japan and I want to go back, but at the same time, I love Japan because of its uniqueness and I guess in some way because of its purity. So it's this dichotomy of, oh, Japan should have more people going in, but oh, Japan should maintain its culture and its traditions and customs. And that might be a real challenge with a foreign population. But maybe I'm thinking of a term I talked with Ken Moggi about, Nagomi. And he often gave examples of both of indigenous Japanese concepts and foreign concepts working together to create this Nagomi, this balance of harmony. So maybe that's the goal, to find this Nagomi, this balance harmony in, I guess, refugee intake and, I guess, increased immigration. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Actually, this traditional idea of harmony, or as you mentioned, Nagomi, can be applied in a very positive way to harmonize society with people from other countries, and not only referring to the purity of the Japanese society. And I think once this idea kicks in the Japanese society, actually Japan might be one of the leading countries to kind of create this harmony within the society with different people with different origin. So at the moment, it has not reached this level yet. And it seems to be that a lot of Japanese people have much more close mindset. But I think there has been a potential for the Japanese society to catch up with this idea and actually try to promote its traditional value in a kind of positive way to accept the diversity. So that's my hope for the future.
Yeah, I mean, for me, living in Japan, it's been such a powerful learning experience and some of the best years of my life. So I certainly hope Japan would have more people to experience what I experienced, and I hope to go back too. So I hope, I hope I can go back when COVID ends. So... Yeah, wonderful country, beautiful people, fascinating culture. So I recommend everyone to at least go once in their life. But let's stay on topic. So your paper explores how the term refugee, nanmin, is used in the Japanese news media. And in 2007, a Japanese journalist popularized the sensational term, I guess, net cafe refugee. So that would be net cafe nanmin. And refers to people who do not have a fixed address and sleep in net cafes, often spending months in these places. And there are many documentaries on this on YouTube, and it's very sad, actually. But I guess my question was, I think your article explores this to some degree, on whether it's an inaccurate or inappropriate use of the word refugee, and would something like just homelessness be more appropriate? Yeah.
Yes. So I look at this evolution of the expression nanmin used as a metaphor. And as you pointed out, the first instance was when this term was employed to refer to people who sleep in internet cafes. And it is interesting that from that point on, the expression nanmin has become a very popular way of making a creative metaphor. So at the beginning, it was based on the visual resemblance. So the journalist actually explained that he came up with this expression because he went to the Neto Cafe to see people sleeping there. He got reminded of the refugee camp he visited some time before. And there are very similar kind of visual elements in the two groups of people. And of course, it provoked a lot of controversy, especially the Association of Internet Cafe did not like the expression used, especially because in the Japanese society, there has been this kind of wrong association between refugees or immigrants in general with the criminality, which is not true, but people still have this negative idea about it. And the owners of internet cafes did not like this association. So they actually made a complaint, official complaint against the media, not to use this expression. However, as you say, the use of language is very natural, so we cannot really control or stop it. So this expression remained in the media space, and people started using this expression to create other metaphors, which is not anymore always based on the visual resemblance. So we just use this expression to refer to loosely people who are not able to do certain things because of various reasons. So we have, for example, information refugees to refer to people who cannot access certain information, maybe because they cannot use the internet or because they don't know how to look for it, or shopping refugees, meaning people who live in a remote area, often elderly people who do not have a car, and there is no shopping facility around their residence. So they actually cannot go regularly shopping, and they don't know how to do, for example, internet shopping. So they actually have a very difficult situation trying to get like daily necessities. Or more recently, they have been expressions like vaccination refugees for those who want to get vaccinated against COVID, but because it's too popular, they cannot get the appointment. Or PCR test refugees that they want to make sure that they are not infected, but it's too popular, so you cannot make an appointment. So there are many, many expressions like this. And as you notice, it's no longer people who are sleeping in a small camp or anything like that. So it's not the idea of visual resemblance, which is important, but it has become more of the marginalization of the Japanese population, which has come into the center of this discourse.
I've just realized this now. Do you think these terms also come up because Japanese language seeks to simplify words or expressions? So if we were talking about insurance in Australia and people who can't afford it, we would just say people who can't afford insurance. Or if people didn't have access to certain facilities because of their location, we'd have to say, they can't access certain things because of their location. Yeah, Japanese always seems to be simplifying their language. So do you think that's part of why all these nanmin words are now popping up as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's so much of the simplification, but it's in a way, catchy way to describe certain things. So it's kind of trendy way of describing the current issues. So as you say, the insurance refugees refer to people who cannot either afford to certain insurance programs or too confused about which program to subscribe to, or perhaps not to have healthy condition to be able to subscribe to an insurance program. So there are various reasons, but those who are not able to benefit from the insurance scheme. So this is the idea. And I guess that the reason why this expression has become so popular is that we do hear this expression in international media a lot because refugee protection has been a very timely issue. And then people wanted to use this expression for current issues within Japan because it's a very catchy, kind of eye-catching expression. And in a way, it's quite flexible and versatile expression that you can use for many things that you want to do something that you cannot do. Mm-hmm. So you just add the noun before nanmin, refugee, and make a lot of expressions. So yeah. This phenomenon, is quite common in Japanese language, I think.
Yeah, I didn't see that until you added some notes. And so that's give me a different perspective. It's not just used for homeless people living at net cafes. Back to your paper. Your paper seeks to unveil the discursive meaning of the term refugee and its possible impact on public perception of issues related to refugee protection. So this is an important theme. Would you like to touch on that?
Yes. So this, I can see a great shift of interest. So when I see the use of the term nanmin in the news, Japanese news media, it is almost more often case of metaphor than the use of actual term refugees for the real refugees. So this kind of took on a new meaning within the Japanese context. So I find this as an interesting example and also alarming example in which this international issue has been kind of reinterpreted, not really issue, but the term to refer to international issue gets reinterpreted within the Japanese domestic context. So kind of the shifting of the point of view from this international global kind of wider view point of view into more a narrower kind of idea about Japanese society. And by using this term of nanmin, it kind of creates the marginalized population. So when you use this expression, sometimes you use this expression for yourself, kind of in a self-deprecating kind of way. So it is not only kind of discriminatory, but in a way, by using this expression, you make some sort of marginalization of the population. So often those who are described as Nanmin, slightly kind of marginalized population, either because they live in a remote area, or they are elderly, or they are not healthy, or they are not rich. And so in a way, it's kind of like the division within the Japanese society. So that is a tendency of the language that I find very interesting and needs more focus. And that's why I decided to write this article.
That is interesting. And on the subject of refugee protection, how much of that would be a concern to the average Japanese?
Yes. So my hypothesis in my article is that because of the term being used in a very domestic context, actually the general public start not to pay attention, too much attention to the actual issue of refugee protection. And that is causing the reason why the civil society is not so much engaged in this issue of refugee protection in Japan. So, of course, it is impossible to evaluate how much this explains the situation. But it is true that if you compare with other countries like in Europe, in Japan, there has not been so much pressure from civil society to, for example, act on the government to tackle the issue, despite the fact Japan is very silently famous for not taking a lot of refugees in the international society. So this has been one of the reasons why, I think.
So this is interesting because, I mean, recently in the West, there's been a lot of debate about words and whether you can say certain words anymore or what words mean. And I read an article about the use of the word tribe, which is part of my business name, Ikigai Tribe, and that could become, that could be an inappropriate use of the word. But in Japan, I don't think they're concerned about word usage as much as we are in the West. And with that, I think loan words seem to stick. And this all goes back to, I guess, ideas and opinions and perspective. But with certain words, maybe like Nanmin, maybe not now, but maybe in the future, do you think there would be a chance of it being corrected and the public being encouraged or warned that, you know, Nanmin for things like for not having access to insurance is just not appropriate and we should stop using it?
Yeah, so actually there has already been discussions about the appropriateness of this expression. So as I mentioned at the very beginning, the owners of Internet Cafe made official complaints. And also in another instance in 2011, when there was an earthquake in Japan, a large East Japan earthquake, and a lot of people got stranded in the station or workplaces. And people, the news media first used the expression of kitaku nanmin, which is like going home refugees, meaning people who are not able to go home. And there had been a huge discussion about it because this, of course, was a very important and a serious event in Japan. And people were highly empathized with all the victims and people who got affected by the event. So a lot of people disliked this expression, saying we should not use the term refugees for those who could not go home because of the earthquake and the transportation system was paralyzed. So immediately after that, the main media outlets stopped using the word refugee for those who could not go home after the earthquake. So the starting topic seems to be more sensitive about the use of language, and especially the earthquakes and natural disasters, because there are lots of victims in the country. We need to treat it with a lot of care and a lot of attention. And people discuss very heavily about the use of language and the appropriateness of this language. So this has happened in Japan as well. And as you mentioned, in other fields as well, the kind of political correctness of the language has become a very important issue. So perhaps maybe less kind of advanced compared to kind of Western societies, but there has been discussion about certain words should be replaced by another expression which is more politically neutral or more less hurting to some people. So with regard to the expression refugees, although it has been used for more than 10 years, mm-hmm. I think it's still within the category of trendy words. So it will probably go at some point, as with the case with many kind of in words or trendy words that come and go every instance. So I think this probably would be the case for refugee metaphor. Indeed, we can already see that number of usage has declined compared to, for example, 2008 today, partly because of the appropriateness of the expression, but also because the word has become used so many times, the people start to get bored with the expression and lose the freshness of the words. However, yes, I think this kind of, in a way, creative metaphor using certain timely expression will probably come back again in another context. And that is, I think, interesting phenomenon to follow up on. So I'm kind of waiting for the new examples.
One new word. Are there any other words that come to mind with a similar interpretation or sort of metaphorical usage other than numbing? Yeah.
So, it's not really a metaphor, but recently I was talking with a colleague about the expression loss. So it's kind of like a trendy way of creating new words. So loss is like to lose something, and we use it when we have lost something or someone passes away. So this is expression, but often in the media, recent Japanese media, people start to create new words combining noun followed by loss to refer to a general kind of looser meaning of missing something after something has passed. So if the festival has happened and it was such a great festival, it has ended, it becomes a festival loss.
Oh, really?
Or something like that. So, or the very famous or very popular TV series caught a lot of attention and it has finished, and then people have this series loss. Or something like that. So the idea of loss has become so much popularized, and I think it started with some sort of expression in a more psychological way, but now it has become so much lighter in meaning, which is kind of similar to the case of refugee, that the meaning has taken on kind of a very light, very daily life-based meaning.
Yeah, so they almost seem to be, as you mentioned, trends as well. There'll be a period of maybe 5 years, 10 years where the word's quite common, and then maybe another word enters the language. So I'm trying to remember if there was something like that going around when I was living in Japan, but I can't off the top of my head. But I think this maybe presents, and this is a question, I guess, does this present a double standard in Japan with the use of language? So not wanting to use loan words to maintain the purity of the language, but at the same time reinventing words, in the case of numbing, perhaps some people would say inappropriately. Yeah, do you think there's a double standard going on?
Yes, it is double standard, definitely, that regarding the use of the loan words, that people do say it is not appropriate to use a lot of foreign words, while people keep using these kind of words. And even those who criticize this kind of words, they definitely do use a large number of long words, because actually it is not even possible to speak with these kind of words today. So people do not realize how much they use this kind of vocabulary, and people still criticize. So it is in a way double standard. And the more the usage increases, the more furious those people become. But actually they use more of those words as well. So I see there's some sort of double standards there. But in terms of this creativity, or they're using these terms like numbing, can also be interpreted as in kind of the tendency to focus on the purity, not only in the Japanese, but this idea of purity of the Japanese society, of homogeneity of the Japanese society. And in the case of this word numbing, people use it kind of wanting to differentiate people who are not in the mainstream. So it's kind of division between mainstream and substream of the society. So this creates more and more kind of substreams. And there's, in the end, even no mainstream people, but they want to kind of keep the idea of the mainstream population homogeneity that remains in a society and describe everyone else as kind of marginalized or substreams. And I think this use of refugees as metaphor is part of this kind of phenomenon. So I think you can kind of connect these two instances in that same perspective from that point of view.
All right, well, I guess we can flip this now and say there are Japanese words or concepts that are often misused or appropriated. And obviously something I care about and I'm trying to undo is ikigai being now associated with the Venn diagram. And it's also associated to longevity. And some people believe it's a word from Okinawa. And some people believe it's your one life purpose. So it's completely misunderstood. But people, coaches use it to sell the programs, to sell books. And then there are words like wabi-sabi, which are completely misunderstood, but used to sell products for interior design. So for you, a Japanese person, what are your thoughts on these concepts that do get appropriated? And and to add to that, what was your impression of the Venn diagram when you first saw it?
Yeah, so as a sociolinguist, I have to say it is part of a very natural linguistic phenomenon. It has happened so many times in so many different cases all over the world. But I find this example of Venn diagram very interesting because the meaning has completely shifted. But I think this has happened in the opposite direction as well. The Japanese language has taken so many Western words and used the Japanese speakers use them in a very different meaning. So in a way, it is understandable. Mm-hmm. And I see many other examples of the similar nature, and especially things like wabi-sabi is a kind of philosophy and difficult concept. So I wouldn't say all the Japanese people use it in an appropriate way or with actual meaning of the concept. So it, in a way, it became a very loose idea that people can use in whatever meaning. And yeah, I think the similar example would be the expression Zen, which I hear quite a lot in the English language or even in French language that I also speak. And people use it as a kind of very loose concept as being calm or being very relaxing, whereas Zen in original meaning is like one denomination of Buddhist religion. And it has a very specific meaning, but now it has become sort of an adjective to mean just very calming, very relaxing. So I see, as you mentioned, a growing number of Japanese words starting to be used in the international context as well, which in a way is a natural process. And I see many other examples. So yeah, I don't think it is a very shocking reality, even though, of course, for someone who studies the concept, it is quite frustrating. I understand that people understand the meaning in a completely different way. But sometimes one concept gets used in a certain community and gain the popularity, it can gain the second meaning and sometimes get re-imported to the source language as well. And in the Japanese language, it has happened kind of more increasingly in the recent history that the originally Japanese words, which had become popular or used in foreign context, re-imported back to the Japanese language, and it gets written as if they were the Western loanwords. So using the particular script type to emphasize that this is an international concept. So that happens as well. So it might be the case that, the word gains the second meaning, and maybe in the future it will come into dictionary as well. So we will never know.
Okay. Well, I hope not for ikigai, because it's such a beautiful concept, obviously in the context of Japanese culture. And what's interesting, I have been able to interview the man responsible for the Venn diagram who merged it with ikigai. And for him, it was just an idea. It took him no more than 40 minutes and it was just a cool idea and nothing more. And he hasn't sought to take advantage of it. He's just a kind of a mischief maker, a fun-loving guy. And on the word wabi-sabi, it was the only word my father-in-law taught me. And he makes pottery. He makes shinoyaki pottery. So when he told me that word, it was a sort of a significant event. He told me it in his kolba when he was packaging up pottery. And you're right, these nouns become adjectives. They seem to become adjectives in the West. And people relate wabi-sabi to imperfect beauty or zen as, yeah, many nouns now. And they say, oh, that's very zen, or this is very zen, thinking it's an adjective. So for someone who studies the impact of words and language, what is your favorite word or one of your favorite words?
It is very difficult to choose. So as you say, yeah, the words are something very, it's like a creature. So it evolves in a way, that, in an unexpected way, and some take some meaning that was not meant to be, as you mentioned, in terms of ikigai, or the case with refugees as well. So, well, as a kind of researcher in this field, I try to take a distance to observe how the world evolves. So I try not to kind of make some personal likings in terms of particular expression or particular words. But when someone asked me what my favorite word is, and kind of jokingly, I say lorem ipsum, which is a word that comes up in kind of blank words, blank documents. Yeah. Well, it actually was kind of random, which is not like corrupt Latin, it's not a language, but it's kind of based from a text written in Latin. And I find it interesting that actually it was taken existing Latin documents about discussing the suffering. So lorem ipsum actually comes from the expression that dolorem ipsum, which is kind of suffering itself. And this is part of the text saying, no one likes suffering itself, but in exchange with some greater pleasure, sometimes people take on some sufferings as an exchange. And giving an example of training yourself and going jogging every day, it might be difficult, but in the end, you get stronger or you get healthier. So you accept to take the suffering. So this is the idea originally meant in this Latin text, which was kind of deformed on purpose to mean nothing and used as kind of example of the font or template of something. But yeah. By knowing this kind of this origin, I find it very interesting that when I see a blank document, a blank presentation, I kind of optimize it, think, yes, this is a suffering to start off writing. But for the satisfaction of writing a good piece, I need to take on this suffering. So in a way, I find a meaning behind it. So it's interesting. And it's a creative word, and it's not a word, but it's used and it's get known. So in a way, it is a word. So I like this expression.
Well, I didn't know that. I mean, I'm aware of it, and people use it to fill out websites when they're designing them to show how the text will look like. So it almost relates to Buddhism, you know, and yeah, looking for someone who's just finished a book, and I know you've also finished a writing project, looking at a blank page thinking, oh, how do I write this next chapter, can be quite painful. But that experience of overcoming suffering or facing a challenge also relates to ikigai, and ikigai is, I guess, a concept that's has all these different perceptions. For many Japanese, it's something small. It might be their pet or their favorite food. But I guess in the field of research, it has all these associations or connections to positive psychology or existential positive psychology. So what is your ikigai? Is it the study of language or the study of words?
Yeah, I mean that of course, definitely takes a large part of my ikigai. So yeah, I was going to say that this concept that I was talking about in terms of the lorem ipsum is definitely related to this idea of ikigai, that you need to take every challenge in your life from a positive point of view to achieve your goal. And yeah, so I really find my research as part of my kind of greater goal. And or rather than saying my research or my kind of looking at words and languages is ikigai, but I kind of decided to turn my ikigai into my work. So previously I worked in a totally different sector, and I really wanted to spend my life looking at things I really get passionate about. So I could not think of anything else than languages and words that I have been always passionate about. So I thought, if you live only once, you definitely need to do what you really love. Mm-hmm. And that was a language. And the way to think about language all the time in my life was to become a researcher in linguistics. So yeah, I think it is fair to say that it is part of my ikigai. And also, in general, I'm interested in language, and more generally, I'm interested in communication. So when I'm having a very good, interesting discussion with other people, that gives me really a great pleasure that this exchange of ideas is something that I appreciate a lot. So that's a moment I feel that this is kind of part of the beautiful, most beautiful part of life in general. So yeah, I'd say that in general, this language, words, and communication, that gives me a sense of ikigai.
I can totally relate. I love having conversations with obviously friends and family, but also I love my podcast, and it's, yeah, something I really strive to do well. So I'll research my guests, I'll read their paper or book, I'll make notes, so that can facilitate a really enjoyable conversation, which I've had with you today. So thank you for that. Before we go, where can people reach out to you? Do you have a website, or is there anywhere you'd like to direct people?
Yes, so there is a profile page on the website of Tokyo College, the University of Tokyo, where I describe my brief summary of my research. And also with my name, I have some articles published, and some of them are available online. So as you mentioned, the article that I wrote on the metaphor of refugees can be found online for the Journal of Multicultural Discourses. And you can read my small article on Kotodama on the Oxford Dictionary blog. So yes, if anyone is interested in reading more about my research, please find these articles and the websites that are available online.
Yeah, we'll put them in the show notes, and people can find them through, yeah, links in the show notes. So Naoko Hosokawa, thank you so much for your time today and for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you very much. That's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, and I look forward to our next conversation. This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.